This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Last week, I read parts of the first chapter and into the second chapter of John Muir's book, The Story of My Boyhood and Youth. He wrote this in 1913, a year before he died. If you missed it, please go to the archived podcasts of Natural Wonders on WDRT.org. I'll start reading about his voyage across the ocean after leaving his birthplace in Dunbar, Scotland, and winding up in Wisconsin in 1849. He was 11 years old. In crossing the Atlantic, before the days of steamships or even the American clippers, the voyages made in old-fashioned sailing vessels were very long. Ours was 6 weeks and 3 days. But because we had no lessons to get, that long voyage had not a dull moment for us boys. Father and sister Sarah, with most of the old folk, stayed below in rough weather, groaning in the miseries of seasickness, many of the passengers wishing they had never ventured in the old rockin' creel, as they called our bluff-bowed, wave-beating ship. And when the weather was moderately calm, singing songs in the evenings, the youthful sailor frank and bold, oh, why left my home, and why did I cross the deep? But no matter how much the old tub tossed about and battered the waves, we were on deck every day, not in the least seasick, watching the sailors at their rope-hauling and climbing work, joining in their songs, learning the names of the ropes and sails, and helping them as far as they would let us, playing games with other boys in calm weather when the deck was dry, and in stormy weather, rejoicing in sympathy with the big, curly-topped waves. The captain occasionally called David and me into his cabin and asked us about our schools, handed us books to read, and seemed surprised to find that Scotch boys could read and pronounce English with perfect accent and knew so much Latin and French. In Scotch schools, only pure English was taught, although not a word of English was spoken out of school. All through life, however well educated, the Scotch spoke Scotch among their own folk, except at times when unduly excited on the only two subjects on which Scotchmen get much excited, namely religion and politics. So long as the controversy went on with fairly level temper, only good braid Scots was used. But if one became angry, as was likely to happen, then he immediately began speaking severely correct English, while his antagonist, drawing himself up, would say, "Weel, there's no use pursuing this subject any further, for I see ye hae gotten to your English." As we neared the shore of the great new land, with what eager wonder we watched the whales and dolphins and porpoises and seabirds, and made the good-natured sailors teach us their names and tell us stories about them. There were quite a large number of emigrants aboard, many of them newly married couples, and the advantages of the different parts of the new world they expected to settle in were often discussed. My father started with the intention of going to the backwoods of Upper Canada. Before the end of the voyage, however, he was persuaded that the states offered superior advantages, especially Wisconsin and Michigan, where the land was said to be as good as in Canada and far more easily brought under cultivation. For in Canada the woods were so close and heavy that a man might wear out his life in getting a few acres cleared of trees and stumps. So he changed his mind and concluded to go to one of the western states. On our wavering westward way, a grain dealer in Buffalo told Father that most of the wheat he handled came from Wisconsin, and this influential information finally determined my father's choice. At Milwaukee, a farmer who had come in from the country near Fort Winnebago with a load of wheat agreed to haul us and our formidable load of stuff to a little town called Kingston for $30. On that 100-mile journey, just after the spring thaw, the roads over the prairies were heavy and miry, causing no end of lamentation, for we often got stuck in the mud, and the poor farmer sadly declared that never, never again would he be tempted to try to haul such a cruel, heartbreaking, wagon-breaking, horse-killing load? No, not for $100. In leaving Scotland, Father, like many other home seekers, burdened himself with far too much luggage, as if all of America were still a wilderness in which little or nothing could be bought. One of his big iron-bound boxes must have weighed about 400 pounds, for it contained an old-fashioned beam scales with a complete set of cast-iron counterweights, two of them 56 pounds each, a 28, and so on down to a single pound. Also a lot of iron wedges, carpenter's tools, and so forth, and at Buffalo, as if on the very edge of the wilderness, he gladly added to his burden a big cast-iron stove with pots and pans, provisions enough for a long siege, and a scythe and cumbersome cradle for cutting wheat, all of which he succeeded in landing in the primeval Wisconsin woods. A land agent at Kingston gave Father a note to a farmer by the name of Alexander Gray, who lived on the border of the settled part of the country, knew section lines, and would probably help him to find a good place for a farm. So Father went away to spy out the land, and in the meantime left us children in Kingston in a rented room. It took us less than an hour to get acquainted with some of the boys in the village. We challenged them to wrestle, run races, climb trees, and so on, and in a day or two we felt at home, carefree and happy, notwithstanding our family was so widely divided. When Father returned, he told us that he had found fine land for a farm in sunny open woods on the side of a lake, and that a team of 3 yoke of oxen with a big wagon was coming to haul us to Mr. Gray's place. We enjoyed the strange 10-mile ride through the woods very much, wondering how the great oxen could be so strong and wise and tame as to pull so heavy a load with no other harness than a chain and a crooked piece of wood on their necks, and how they could sway so obediently to right and left past roadside trees and stumps when the driver said haw and gee. At Mr. Gray's house, Father again left us for a few days to build a shanty on the quarter section he had selected 4 or 5 miles to the westward. In the meanwhile, we enjoyed our freedom as usual, wandering in the fields and meadows, looking at the trees and flowers. With the help of the nearest neighbors, the little shanty was built in less than a day after the rough bur oak logs for the walls and the white oak boards for the floor and roof were got together. To this charming hut in the sunny woods, overlooking a flowery glacier meadow and a lake rimmed with white water lilies, we were hauled by an ox team across trackless carex swamps and low rolling hills sparsely dotted with round-headed oaks. Just as we arrived at the shanty, before we had time to look at it or the scenery about it, David and I jumped down in a hurry off the load of household goods, for we had discovered a blue jay's nest, and in a minute or two we were up the tree beside it, feasting our eyes on the beautiful green eggs and beautiful birds. Our first memorable discovery. The handsome birds had not seen Scotch boys before and made a desperate screaming as if we were robbers like themselves, though we left the eggs untouched, feeling that we were already beginning to get rich and wondering how many more nests we could find in the grand sunny woods. Then we ran along the brow of the hill that the shanty stood on and down to the meadow, searching the trees and grass tufts and bushes, and soon discovered a bluebird's and a woodpecker's nest, and began an acquaintance with the frogs and snakes and turtles in the creeks and springs. This sudden plash into pure wildness, baptism in nature's warm heart, how utterly happy it made us. Nature streaming into us, wooingly teaching her wonderful glowing lessons, so unlike the dismal grammar ashes and cinders so long thrashed into us. Here, without knowing it, we were still at school, every wild lesson a love lesson, not whipped, but charmed into us. All that glorious Wisconsin wilderness, everything new and pure, in the very prime of the spring when nature's pulses were beating highest and mysteriously keeping time with our own. Young hearts, young leaves, flowers, animals, the winds and the streams and the sparkling lake, all wildly, gladly, rejoicing together. We greatly admired the plucky kingbird. In Scotland, our great ambition was to be good fighters, and we admired this quality in the handsome little chattering flycatcher that whips all the other birds. He was particularly angry when plundering jays and hawks came near his home and took pains to thrash them, not only away from the nest tree, but out of the neighborhood. The nest was usually built on a bur oak near a meadow where insects were abundant and where no undesirable visitor could approach without being discovered. When a hen hawk hove in sight, the male immediately set off after him, and it was ridiculous to see that great, strong bird hurrying away as fast as his clumsy wings would carry him as soon as he saw the little waspish kingbird coming. But the kingbird easily overtook him, flew just a few feet above him, and with a lot of chattering, scolding notes, kept diving and striking him on the back of the head until tired. Then he alighted to rest on the hawk's broad shoulders, still scolding and chattering as he rode along, like an angry boy pouring out vials of wrath. Then up and at him again with his sharp bill, and after he had thus driven and ridden his big enemy a mile or so from the nest, he went home to his mate, chuckling and bragging as if trying to tell her what a wonderful fellow he was. We never tired listening to the wonderful whippoorwill. One came every night about dusk and sat on a log about 20 or 30 feet from our cabin door and began shouting, "Whippoorwill, whippoorwill," with loud, emphatic earnestness. "What's that? What's that?" we cried, when this startling visitor first announced himself. "What do you call it?" "Why, it's telling you its name," said the Yankee, who father hired to help him work the land. "Don't you hear it? And what he wants you to do? He says his name is Poor Will, and he wants you to whip him, and you may if you're able to catch him." Poor Will seemed the most wonderful of all the strange creatures we had seen. What a wild, strong, bold voice he had, unlike any other we had ever heard on sea or land. A near relative, the bull bat or nighthawk, seemed hardly less wonderful. Towards evenings, scattered flocks kept the sky lively as they circled around on their long wings, 100 feet or more above the ground, hunting moths and beetles, interrupting their rather slow but strong, regular wing beats at short intervals with quick, quivering strokes, while uttering keen, squeaky cries, and every now and then diving nearly to the ground with loud, ripping, bellowing sound like bull roaring, suggesting its name, then turning and gliding swiftly up again. These fine, wild, gray birds, about the size of a pigeon, lay their 2 eggs on bare ground without anything like a nest or even a concealing bush or grass tuft. Nevertheless, they are not easily seen, for they are colored like the ground. While sitting on their eggs, they depend so much upon not being noticed that if you are walking rapidly ahead, they allow you to step within an inch or two of them without flinching. But if they see by your looks that you have discovered them, they leave their eggs or young, and like a good many other birds, pretend that they are sorely wounded, fluttering and rolling over on the ground, and gasping as if dying to draw you away. When pursued, we were surprised to find that just when we were at the point of overtaking them, they were always able to flutter a few yards farther, until they had led us about 1/4 of a mile from the nest, and then suddenly, getting well, they quietly flew home by a roundabout way to their precious babies or eggs, or all the ills of life victorious, bad boys among the worst. Everything about us was so novel and wonderful that we could hardly believe our senses except when hungry or while father was thrashing us. When we first saw Fountain Lake Meadow, on a sultry evening, sprinkled with millions of lightning bugs, throbbing with light, the effect was so strange and beautiful that it seemed far too marvelous to be real. Looking from our shanty on the hill, I thought that the whole wonderful fairy show must be in my eyes, for only in fighting, when my eyes were struck, had I ever seen anything in the least like it. But when I asked my brother if he saw anything strange in the meadow, he said, "Yes, it's all covered with shaky fire sparks." Then I guessed that it might be something outside of us, and applied to our all-knowing Yankee to explain it. "Oh, that's nothing but lightning bugs," he said, and kindly led us down the hill to the edge of the fiery meadow, caught a few of the wonderful bugs, dropped them into a cup, and carried them to the shanty, where we watched them throbbing and flashing out their mysterious light at regular intervals, as if each little passionate glow were caused by the beating of a heart. Once I saw a splendid display of glowworm light in the foothills of the Himalayas, north of Calcutta, but glorious as it appeared in pure starry radiance, it was far less impressive than the extravagant, abounding, quivering, dancing fire on our Wisconsin meadow. Partridge drumming was another great marvel. When I first heard the low, soft, solemn sound, I thought it must be made by some strange disturbance in my head or stomach. But as all seemed serene within, I asked David whether he heard anything queer. "Yes," he said, "I hear something saying whoomp, boomp, boomp, and I'm wondering at it." Then I was half satisfied that the source of the mysterious sound must be in something outside of us, coming perhaps from the ground or from some ghost or bogey or woodland fairy. Only after long watching and listening did we at last discover it in the wings of the plump brown bird. The love song of the common jacksnipe seemed not a whit less mysterious than partridge drumming. It was usually heard on cloudy evenings, a strange, unearthly, winnowing, spirit-like sound, yet easily heard at a distance of a third of a mile. Our sharp eyes soon detected the bird while making it, as it circled high in the air over the meadow, with wonderfully strong and rapid wing beats, suddenly descending and rising again and again in deep, wide loops, the tones being very low and smooth at the beginning of the descent, rapidly increasing to a curious little whirling storm roar at the bottom, and gradually fading lower and lower until the top was reached. It was long, however, before we identified this mysterious wing singer as the little brown jacksnipe that we knew so well and had so often watched as he silently probed the mud around the edges of our meadow, stream, and spring holes and made short zigzagging flights over the grass, uttering only little short crisp quacks and chucks. The love songs of the frogs seemed hardly less wonderful than those of the birds, their musical notes varying from the sweet, tranquil, soothing peeping and purring of the hylas to the awfully deep, low, bass, blunt bellowing of the bullfrogs. Some of the smaller species have wonderfully clear, sharp voices and told us their good Bible names in musical tones about as plainly as the whippoorwill. Isaac, Isaac, Jacob, Jacob, Israel, Israel, shouted in sharp, ringing, far-reaching tones as if they had all been to school and severely drilled in elocution. In the still, warm evenings, big, bunchy bullfrogs bellowed, "Drunk, drunk, drunk, jug-a-rum, jug-a-rum," and early in the spring, countless thousands of the commonest species up to the throat in cold water, sang in concert, making a mass of music such as it was loud enough to be heard at a distance of more than half a mile. And I will end here and continue next week reading John Muir's wonderful story of his boyhood and youth. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.